Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
We have 21 companies representing a variety of products from bulk grains to tree nuts to snacks to beverages, so a little bit of everything. And then we have 11 state departments of agriculture that have joined us, and these cover the U.S. all the way from Maine to Montana and Texas to North Dakota.
Talks participation in and purpose of an ag trade mission to Spain, Clay Hamilton with the Foreign Ag Service.
And we also have some of our trade associations represented. These programs are very important. Not only do they help us maintain and develop contacts, but they give us a chance to really build bridges. We had tremendous reception from the buyers, and so we're really looking for a lot of opportunities to come from this trade mission. So over the next couple of weeks, we'll be collecting information to see just how productive it was.
This is Agriculture Today.
I do continue to believe that there's a path to a soft or softish landing. I do believe that.
And the definition of a softish landing is what? Soft. Unemployment goes up a little, but we don't have a recession?
Yeah.
Jerome Powell is the chair of the Federal Reserve, speaking recently at a Brookings Institute event.
Unemployment goes up, but it's not a hard landing. It's not a severe recession. You know, you could think of unemployment going up, but not. You know, really spiking as it does in some recessions. So that's how I think about it. And I think the path is pretty clear. The labor market conditions soften. We see inflation and, the goods inflation gets better. Housing services inflation gets better. And the labor market softens but doesn't go into recession. And you see inflation start to come down. And, I mean, I think that's very plausible. I don't want to be the handicapper on it. And, of course, our job is to try to achieve that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's still achievable. Although, if you look at the history, it's not a likely outcome. But I would just say this is a different set of circumstances.
While recession continues to be a concern, another is labor issues.
On labor force participation, I think it's useful to go back, 10 years, and the forecast that mainstream labor economists had was that, and you're right, aging of the population leads to declining labor force participation. Notwithstanding that, labor force participation was in effect flat and a little bit up from 2013 to 2020, roughly. And that was because you had a strong, tight labor market. People were staying in the labor market longer than expected. That was really what it was. So our ability to predict is not perfect in this, except over long periods of time, you have an aging population, so you're probably going to have declining labor force participation. I don't think it's reasonable to expect that we get all the way back to where we were with labor force participation in 2020 at 63.7, I guess, population adjusted. I don't see that, but I wouldn't rule it out. And we're nowhere near that now. We're a point and a half below that now. So the real question is, do we expect to see big chunks of labor force participation? I got to say, this year we've seen, in the aggregate, not much, and it's been very disappointing and a little bit surprising. So that's part of the story. The other part, as I mentioned, is population. Is that the labor force, a big part of the shortfall in labor force is actually population.
Though the Fed may appear to live within a bubble, Powell says they do look at how their policy will affect others.
We absolutely believe that we take that into consideration. The model's explicitly taken into consideration. Of course, they're not perfect. No one would say we do it perfectly. But we have a very large global model that we use for the global economy, and it absolutely takes into account what's happening with the real economy and monetary tightening and currency and all those things. It won't be perfect, but we do that. And we also sort of understand generally that there's a lot of research and things. People are talking about this a lot right now, that, maybe the whole is bigger than the sum of the parts when it comes to tightening. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but we're aware of the risk of that. But again, I come back to, look where we are. We've raised, 375 basis points. Markets are working. I think we're now in a position where we're in a place where we really can get inflation under control, and unemployment's at 3.7%. So we haven't done. I don't regret getting to where we are, and I think broadly the world will be better off if we can get this over quickly.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I think we have really good news in 2023 in agriculture, starting with the fact that this pesky doggone La Nina is finally going to conk out here, hopefully in about March or April.
Greg Dowd is former chief ag negotiator, U.S. Trade Representative's office, on why he's optimistic.
And given the drought in the United States and the situation that we're in here, we can't handle any more of this. And I think finally we're going to get some relief from Mother Nature here. I think 2023 is going to be a big change for us in terms of renewable green diesel and the big expansion in that, and the production of that commodity is going to come online here in a big way. And I think 2022 has been a tremendous year for us in terms of meat exports. And frankly, I think that's going to continue despite the turmoil in the world and everything that's going on. I do have the sense that China's going to continue to stick with us in terms of beef trade and on the meat side of the equation, despite all the difficulties and everything going on. On the policy side of the equation, I wish everybody in Washington would take a hard look at where we want to be 10 years from now and what is the strategy that we need to implement today to get us where we need to be going forward. And I think that conversation starts with the U.K., I think we need to continue to engage with Kenya and Ecuador, Southeast Asia. I appreciate the Indo-Pacific partnership and what this administration is talking about there. But I do believe, based upon all the conversations I have, there's going to be precious little related to agriculture or ag market access in that discussion. But that's okay. That's okay for now, because we need to continue to focus on Southeast Asia. And whether that's a trade and investment framework agreement with Taiwan, and I think those talks need to continue, or hopefully they will. What we can do in terms of a digital aspect, financial services, et cetera, in Southeast Asia, that's all important work and a precursor to moving us on down the road there. And I think given the competition that we're going to see from Brazil and their interrelationships between Brazil and Russia and China, going forward in agriculture, I think the concentration and emphasis on Southeast Asia is warranted, and hopefully we can give that a little more energy here going forward in the coming year and beyond.
Not only is he optimistic, but he says the U.S. is plainly in better shape than others.
If you look at the top 10 economies in the world, starting with the U.S., number two is China, number three is Japan, which is actually in fairly decent shape, relatively speaking. We've talked about China is in really, really difficult shape. Number four is Germany. It's a disaster there. And even worse, number five is the U.K. Then you have Russia in there at number 11. The point being, if you've got the second, fourth, and fifth largest economies in the world in a really seriously difficult recessionary spot, the U.S. economy isn't doing great, but it's doing better than anybody else. You know, it's the old adage, two guys running away from a bear. You don't have to outrun the bear. You just have to outrun the other guy. Well, in doing so, it is creating a situation where the strength of our currency is much higher than these other folks. Our interest rates are higher, and that attracts U.S. dollars. Unfortunately, I just don't see a situation, at least in the coming year and maybe a little beyond that, where that's going to change. And that is because of the difficulty these other major economies in the world are having.
Speaking at a recent Farm Foundation forum, former chief ag negotiator for USTR, Greg Dowd. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
With, you know, limited well capacities, and again, it's so dry, meeting those water needs is going to be tough.
A majority of the High Plains cotton crop has been in drought. Dr. Ed Barnes with Cotton Incorporated.
And so one of the things, in West Texas there, Jim Burdowski was a longtime ag engineer, did some really, you know, groundbreaking work on understanding how to manage water in cotton, you know, and he showed pretty conclusively that a lot of pre-watering is not a good use of that water. So, you got to have water to get the crop out of the ground, but trying to bank it, he's demonstrated over many years that that's just not a good way to go. You really want to save that water for when the crop's up, when you're starting to get squares and flowers on it. That's when you're going to get the biggest return on your your investment. So that's one, you know, kind of easy thing. And then it gets, you know, more challenging as the crop gets up and you start thinking, okay, when do I put that next irrigation out? And so there are a lot of tools out there. And if you'll bear with me, I'll call out Cotton Cultivated again, just so people can find some of those tools. If you go to that website, you'll see at the pretty close to the top of the page, as you scroll a little bit down, there's a button called Production. And you click on Production, and then it'll bring up kind of the different protection steps during the year. And one of those is water management. And so you click on water management, and that's going to pull up a lot of the water management resources around the country. You can even go one step further, and if you want to filter it down to the region, you can filter it down. Say you're in the Southwest, you can filter it down so you only get, you know, kind of information relative to the Southwest. So that's a tool that I would encourage people to take a look at.
Barnes talks about the Cotton Cultivated website.
Once you get into that water management section, there, you know, for a lot of the Southwest, there's going to be, and hopefully many people are aware of this, but there's the Texas ET network, and this, there'll be a link to that site that will, Texas A&M maintains, where you can find different weather stations in the Texas area that will kind of give a sense of how much ET is occurring or how much water is evaporating or potentially could evaporate. And then there's also a link, and I have kind of a fond memories of this, Oklahoma Mesonet, which give away my age a little bit, but I was working at Oklahoma State when they were finishing up that Mesonet, and that's the weather station in every county. And so that's a really great resource, and they have an irrigation planner that's available there. So there's a lot of specific scheduling resources. Another one we're working on that won't come up under the Southwest page because we're still kind of refining it for the Southwest, but we do have it linked in with Oklahoma Mesonet, and that's a smart irrigation app for your phone that, again, will be under that water management tab. And that can be – that's in both the Apple Store and the Android Play Store. So it gives you a way to get, you know, kind of predictions of what's the water status in your exact field.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I think we start this conversation with Brazil.
Speaking at a recent Farm Foundation forum, former chief ag negotiator for the U.S. Trade Representative's Office, Greg Dowd.
I think it is really remarkable. 2023 will be really remarkable in terms of, as we look a year from now, in the size and scope of expansion of farm production in Brazil. We think soybean acres will be up about 4%, but I'm particularly interested to see how much corn Brazil is going to grow. USDA currently has them at 47 million tons of corn exports upcoming here. That compares to 55 out of the U.S. And when it comes to China and how much corn they're going to need, USDA says 18 million tons. I think we're going to have to keep a very close eye on that. Because today, when you look at Brazil, Russia, India, China, the BRIC countries in agriculture, they're formidable. And they're talking to each other, and particularly related to fertilizer. And so I think this is a topic and seeing the potential for the world bifurcate in terms of what's going on with Brazil and Russia and China versus what's going on with the rest of the world. With regard to China, I think it's important to note the economic growth situation in China and what we see after a significant delay. China reported their third quarter GDP growth of 3.9%. And I find this very curious considering that Hong Kong recently came out with a GDP figure for the same time period of negative 4.5. So you have positive 3.9 in China at the same time. You have negative 4.5 in Hong Kong. And I don't know how you reconcile that. We do see hog prices in China that have more than doubled in the last year, despite the COVID lockdowns that continue. There's some nearly 300 million people in China experiencing basically no movement whatsoever or no economic generation whatsoever due to COVID. You've got issues in real estate, and coming out of the Party Congress, you saw President Xi talk about the importance of national security over economic growth, and we find that quite curious.
But when it comes to tariffs and agriculture, Dowd explains.
Tariffs aren't that significant of an impediment in agricultural trade today in that part of the world. There's still some tariffs there in the 8, 10, 15, maybe even 20% range in some cases. But, you know, a 10% tariff isn't prohibitive and kept at a side of the market like we dealt with in South Korea for years, or like what we had with Japan before we got the Phase 1 agreement. And so with keeping in mind now with Japan, we have TPP treatment in agriculture for over 90% of our trade in that part of the world. The only thing we don't have is where we had to share tariff-free quotas with other countries. We're in great shape. You know, countries like Taiwan, the tariffs aren't that high. Much more needed work, in my opinion, in dealing with SBS issues in places and licensing issues with Indonesia. Would really like to see us work with Indonesia, and we had a great relationship with them, with their trade minister. He was their ambassador here, then became trade minister over there. I think there's real opportunity to work with them over there in that part of the world. So as I said in my remarks, let's keep working in that part of the world, despite the fact that it isn't necessarily agricultural market access. There can be a lot of things done here to build upon those relationships, and quite frankly, keep those countries in our orbit with regard to these issues and regulatory ways of doing business as opposed to China.
Former chief ag negotiator for USTR, Greg Dowd. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I think that's what makes this so bullish, is because the geographical area basically is the whole western part of the U.S.
Kirk Donsbach is a risk management specialist with StoneX in Wyoming.
We had a better year this year, but last year we got hammered by the drought, essentially. No hay, no grass. I personally had to liquidate about 25%, but there was up to 100% liquidation in some parts of Montana. And that basically stretched from California to Texas to Montana. So huge, massive area of liquidation. And no real rebuilding of that since then.
But as prices continue to increase, there is growing concern of demand destruction.
I would not say that we've hit that point, but demand is very relative to price, right? Where is our demand relative to $1.20 fats versus where is our demand for $1.60 fats? We are historically at a very high live cattle price and a high box beef price and very high retail meat prices. So demand deterioration is very much a concern. And then you add the economic situation into it of a potential recession coming, I think likely in my opinion. And all of a sudden, how high is high, in my opinion, becomes lower. So I'm very concerned about the demand side.
There's also concerns about declining exports.
The accumulated totals are very, very high, very high. But in the last 4 weeks, there's been a very concerning trend of our exports falling off, especially in a seasonally very strong beef export month, November. Typically, we're pushing up to 25,000 metric ton of beef export sales. I think this last report was about 13,000, if I remember right. And that's the fourth week in a row of lower than last year's beef export sales. So there is some concerning trends coming out of the export side. And then again, that all ties back to the high price. The Chinese are very good and very sensitive to the price influence on their purchases. And they're very good at buying bottoms.
And you can never discount the importance of China.
The Chinese have become a huge, huge player in our export market. I believe they're the third or the fourth biggest buyer of our meat. To replace that wholly, if they completely slipped back, would be very difficult, very difficult. And remember, we're talking about a global recession potentially, so it's not just the Chinese.
If there are concerns about volatility, Donsbach says markets can actually help.
That's exactly what they're there for, especially when they're built. They've got a $2 premium built into the deferreds. You've got August, September, November all sitting at or over $2 feeders, so an 800-pounder. In my opinion, that definitely merits taking a serious look at.
And simply put, market does have tools.
It's a real quick crash course in hedging. You've got futures, which is essentially a sale, and that would tie back into those $2 plus fall futures. And not that you'd have to do them all. I would recommend, say, a third of your total production. All of a sudden, the math starts to work somewhat similar to an option without the premium. You've got a put option, which is like an insurance policy, and then you literally have the LRP government-subsidized policy. And I think all those are worth looking at. The options in the LRP are expensive, and you're definitely giving up some as you eliminate the risk that is attached to those tools.
And Dunsbach also says he has weekly commentary. It's free.
You can find me online. It's googlestonex.com. Or I actually produce a weekly newsletter on the cattle markets, and you can subscribe to that by texting cattle, C-A-T-T-L-E, to 33777. And it'll walk you through the process. And that's free, no obligation.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The scheduling apps are great, but they do have limitations. And so sometimes that app may not have me predicting the right crop coefficient for your field because a lot of them use growing degree models.
Dr. Ed Barnes is with Cotton Incorporated.
And another big uncertainty, you know, you get a 1-inch rainfall and it comes in 30 minutes. How much of that stayed on the field, right? Even if you have a rain gauge in the field, how much of it stayed there and didn't go into the ditch? So moisture sensors really answer those questions for you. And so I'm a big fan of them. I think, again, you get a sense of how did that either rainfall or irrigation, how deep did it make it into the profile? Is it still a, you know, how long is it going to be available to the plant? And so I think it's a really important tool. I've seen, you know, examples of where that someone was planning an irrigation. This was more in the Mid-South, but they were furrow irrigating and I had sensors in the field and, you know, it didn't. So I thought you irrigated, and they said they did. And the sensor hadn't moved, so we went out there with a shovel. You know, sometimes you can't trust the sensor either. But sure enough, the furrow was wet, but there was that the furrow had kind of crusted over. And so it was just a, you know, like a concrete ditch, and they were just running water across the field. It wasn't getting to the plant. And, you know, if you don't have a sensor there, you may not know that's happening. And so I'm real high on those. One of the things and what makes them, you know, really great now is it used to be you had to trudge out into the field to say if you had a tensiometer or some sensor out there and read it. And that really made it not practical for a lot of people. And, you know, now most of these, all of them have wireless options. So you can either set up a cell modem or different ways to transmit that data in real time. And if people are interested in that, this is something that Mississippi has done. And I don't think it doesn't matter if you don't live in Mississippi. They have they call it a soil moisture showcase. And what they do is they get all the different companies, maybe not all, but a lot of the companies that make these soil moisture sensors, and they set them up in the same field, and then they kind of give a guest password to all the different systems, and so you can actually test drive these sensors. And so if you're thinking about, well, do I want to invest in this? What, you know, which one should I buy? I'd encourage people to take a look at that. I've also put that and go back to Cotton Cultivated again, get sick of me saying it, but I've got that set up so when you click on production and then water management right now, that will be one of the top hits you get. It would be called the Soil Moisture Showcase.
If you want to learn more about this app, where can you find it?
One thing we try to do with that site, too, is make sure it pulls out your local resources, too. So, if you're in Texas, it's going to direct. We're trying to pull out, you know, the relevant parts of the Texas A&M websites that are focused on cotton. Or whether that's Oklahoma State or, you know, whatever university resources that are out there as well. And then it also, you know, Ryan Kurtz also has this Focus on Cotton series. And that site will also pull you to those resources. And there's always some very timely webcasts. Right now there's one, you know, we're kind of just starting the season out. So there's one on the cotton market and things like that. And so, But that's another one. You can kind of scroll down the the cotton cultivated page and see some of the recent webcasts that are out there.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
First of all, you're starting to see those pandemic, and you're trailing off on all those USDA and non-USDA pandemic payments that were really big in 2020 and 2021.
USDA's chief economist, Dr. Seth Meyer.
Kind of the traditional government payments that are a function of prices, so things like ARC and PLC. Obviously, with the prices that we're seeing now, those don't trigger a whole lot. So there's not a lot of expenses there. There are some increases year over year in government payments for some disaster assistance programs, but you're talking about coming down well off of the direct government payments that you observed in 2020 during the height of the pandemic. Much more in line with a more, close to a more 10-year average on what direct government payments are.